Hi everyone, it's Karen Webster and welcome to Topic TBD, our weekly series on the things that are making news and also newsworthy. Today I'm delighted to be joined by Alex Sonneborg, founder at Lawnmower. Lawnmower, though, is not about cutting your grass, right, Alex?
That's right.
I need to get into the details of why the name, but Lawnmower is really about learning and investing in blockchain assets, aka Bitcoin, which of course has been in the news a lot this week given the developments on Tuesday, November the 8th. So how is Bitcoin doing since the surprise results of our election?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on. Bitcoin, as in the context of the election, we really saw, as it looked like Trump was going to be elected, we sort of saw a rally with assets like Bitcoin and also with things like gold, which is really kind of to be expected since it's a bit away from sort of traditional governments and sort of almost used as a hedge for broader macroeconomic uncertainty. So we also saw a rally with Bitcoin like earlier in the year when we saw the Brexit event happening or any sort of capital controls type event. So really when you see this sort of political uncertainty and macroeconomic uncertainty, a lot of people look to assets like Bitcoin and gold as sort of a hedge or sort of to really get something outside the realm of geopolitics and such.
I was pretty happy that I like gold jewelry, so I was pretty happy that my my jewelry collection got a little more valuable. That was a good thing. but why are people investing in Bitcoin? I mean, there's been this controversy over, you know, is Bitcoin a currency or is it really an asset that people are investing in because they want to ride the appreciation? What is your take on that?
Yeah, I think really even trying to label it, you know, is this a currency? Is it a commodity? Is it an asset? It's really a bit confusing because it doesn't really fall in just one of these categories. So, I mean, part of the reason Bitcoin's so great is that it does work well as a currency. I mean, you can use it to, say, pay a merchant. If they were to accept it, you know, we're not going to have to pay sort of credit card processing fees of 2 or 3%. It also works good as sort of a more global currency. So, you know, if I have family in Japan, instead of trying to use, like, Western Union or some remittance service that are normally plagued with pretty high fees and a really long sort of time to go through like the ACH network and then, you know, other networks like SIPO or something in Europe or Asia. Bitcoin, you know, you can send a transaction, have it settled in the other person's wallet in about 10 minutes for a few cents. So, you know, it works really well as a currency. I also think it's interesting. I mean, I hold a lot of my liquid wealth in Bitcoin, which I view as kind of, you know, obviously really like an alternative investment, but at the same time, you know, you can use this to pay for things. You know, sometimes my friends, my co-founders really like, I'll pay them for, you know, splitting a meal bill. It can really just be used as a lot of things. You know, the commodity analogy works really well. A lot of people compare it to gold because it's more of a limited supply and sort of on the context of, you know, why are people investing when they see broader macroeconomic uncertainty? It's like, hey, the supply is known. You know, the Federal Reserve or central banks can't go and print more money. So really, I think it falls in a lot of categories. It could really be considered like an investable alternative asset, a commodity, a currency. And I think really just trying to put it in one of those buckets probably causes more confusion for people than is really necessary.
So you've been at this, what, for about a year, the lawnmower business?
Actually, about almost 2 years. We started this at the very start of 2015.
Got it. And so how has Bitcoin behaved over the course of that year? It's been very volatile. So has that been more attractive to people who want to invest in Bitcoin or less attractive?
I will say when we launched our app, it was April of 2015. Bitcoin was trading at about $230. Now it's at about $700, so, you know, that's quite a bit of appreciation. It has been somewhat volatile in the meantime, but, I mean, since about a year and a half ago, it's been on a pretty steady upward trend. So, you know, more active traders do see volatility as this opportunity to make profit. I would say from our app, we're focused on a lot more of just the passive investment side. So a lot of our users have, like, recurring purchases set up. So, for example, you know, I want to invest $20 a week regardless of the price, kind of a strategy called dollar cost averaging in traditional investments. So personally, like, I'm very bullish on Bitcoin in the long run. I'm scared and I don't even want to get involved in really short-term trades, so I'd rather just take the passive approach. You know, I'm bullish on the asset. I'm just going to kind of continue to add to my position over time. Really, the day-to-day volatility is something I want to avoid. I'm not going to buy Bitcoin and sell it 2 hours later. And that's kind of the user we more appeal to, of sort of here's some education and information really on Bitcoin and some of these other assets, and here's just a really way to easy way to sort of passively invest into it, hold it over time, and sort of track your analytics. So our app isn't per se focused on like a day trader. It's more on like a passive buy and hold investor.
So it's volatility, though, is what makes it hard for a lot of people to wrap their heads around Bitcoin as a plausible currency. I mean, you don't want that kind of volatility in the currency that you're using to buy stuff on a day-to-day basis. I mean, just ask the folks in Argentina how that's worked. So it's, you know, as a commodity or an asset, I mean, you do expect the volatility. I mean, stocks go up and down, bonds go up and down, you know, it's gold goes up and down, but I don't know. I mean, I think that's what makes the digital currency aspect of Bitcoin a little hard to swallow.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, like you said, you know, there's a bunch of other sovereign currencies that don't do too hot either words. And, you know, a lot of people in South America would probably look to Bitcoin and say, wow, this, you know, currency actually retains value probably better than my sovereign currency, which is crazy. From a merchant's perspective, you know, if they're, for example, afraid of the volatility, which makes sense, you know, you don't want to take a payment and then hold Bitcoin and have it be worth, you know, 10% less the next day. You know, the market is maturing and there are services, for example, Coinbase. You know, if I'm Target, I'd like to accept Bitcoin because, you know, there's no credit card processing fees, but I don't per se want to hold Bitcoin. They have a service, for example, where end users can pay in Bitcoin. They'll sort of convert it to fiat currency on the fly and send me that fiat currency. So, you know, if I just want to appeal and get as much consumers as possible, and there's a lot of demand for paying in Bitcoin, not that there really is a huge demand for paying merchants in Bitcoin, but, you know, if you want to accept Bitcoin and you don't actually want to hold Bitcoin because you're afraid of the volatility, there's services to help manage that. So as the ecosystem matures, you know, there will be services to kind of help users avoid that volatility and just use the rails for the sort of advantages of quick and cheap payments.
What's the profile of the typical investor on the Lawnmower platform?
Yes, so definitely a technical, pretty young audience. So I would say probably 80% of our existing user base is between 18 and 45 years old, usually male. Most of them live in San Francisco or New York, and most of them either work in or have a strong interest in tech and or finance. So, you know, these are a lot of young sort of tech-savvy people that are sort of comfortable holding and managing their own wealth, kind of as you'd expect to be kind of the tier one user base. The sort of one level up from that makes a lot of sense that we're trying to attract is, you know, people that use apps like Robinhood or Acorns or Motif Investing, sort of these little bit more independent apps where, you know, sort of younger folks want to do a little bit of their own research, perhaps don't want to have all their money with their financial advisor or use some advised product, and they kind of want to be a little more involved in their holdings and are comfortable with a little more risk, obviously. So I often compare sort of the risk profile of some of these blockchain assets to things like small cap tech stocks. You know, people will allocate, you know, call it 2 to 10% of their portfolio commonly to alternative investments. Some people choose to invest in startup equity. Some choose to buy these small cap tech stocks, and some choose gold as an alternative investment. And that's kind of how we see a lot of our user base viewing Bitcoin in the context of their overall portfolio too.
If we were charting the performance of Bitcoin versus the S&P 500 and, you know, the small cap index and gold and oil, what would the chart look like?
Generally, in the past few years, I mean, all of those things have kind of gone up. I will say, in general, Bitcoin kind of fits the mold of what I'd call an uncorrelated asset. I will say, at sometimes, like this election, for example, we saw S&P 500 and Dow futures really go down, and during that same time, Bitcoin and gold went up. But instead of really being a completely opposite correlated asset, it's just kind of removed almost. So a lot of times you'll see a big trend in fixed income or in equities, and then Bitcoin will just kind of do its own thing almost. But rather than being extremely correlated, I think it's more so just uncorrelated or negatively correlated, because, you know, when people do sort of, you know, have that fear in a certain asset class and look to alternatives, you know, it's stuff like gold and Bitcoin that just don't fit the mold, and people see as more of a hedge to sort of the rest of their portfolio.
So is that what you're thinking, fear is what drives the price of Bitcoin up?
I think definitely, you know, doubt or being scared of sort of the macroeconomic climate definitely helps drive Bitcoin. You know, people sort of look to alternatives to other financial assets when they see them crashing down, especially when they start to doubt the overall system behind it. In addition, I mean, the Bitcoin ecosystem is just rapidly maturing. You know, we have companies raising more money than ever, attracting user base, actually starting to spend marketing dollars, actually have a bunch of, like, live applications. For example, like the Circle app lets you do remittance from sort of the U.S. over to the U.K. Using the Bitcoin payment rails in the background. Just really as the ecosystem matures and we actually start to see sort of user-friendly apps actually take advantage of the technology, I mean, I think that starts to organically bring new users in. As more people start to hear about it, you know, it drives media to write about it. As the price goes up, people, you know, have this fear of missing out, and it kind of all snowballs on itself. But definitely, like, broader uncertainty in macroeconomic climate or any talk of capital controls or really, like, fear of the sort of governments or central banks just printing a bunch of money, that definitely makes people consider alternatives like Bitcoin, and that along with just the ecosystem maturing, both sort of cause the demand for getting into this asset.
And do you have any concern given the concentration of miners, which is, you know, obviously how all of, you know, all of the Bitcoin assets are exchanged? I mean, does anyone worry about the concentration of those miners in China, given the uncertainty with respect to China, and now in particular with the new presidential administration? I mean, isn't that cause for concern?
Yeah, so there probably is about, you know, 90%+ of mining concentration in China. So just taking a step back, the miners are who bring sort of the new supply into the ecosystem. So, you know, they're the recipients of a lot of the new block rewards from Bitcoin. And if you look, a lot of trading volume is also pretty concentrated in China. Definitely some people are concerned about that. I'm not so much, but it's definitely something that I would say that is on a lot of people's radars. A lot of people have sort of different perceptions of, you know, what would be the result of the Chinese government stepping in. But it's definitely a significant data point at an absolute minimum.
Right. And then, of course, there are the exchanges that, you know, all of them haven't had a great track record for being safe and secure places to have those assets exchanged. You know, it's people don't like, even though it's a speculative investment and people know that going into it, your $200 investment could be zero, people don't really like it when it happens like that.
Absolutely not. And, you know, that is a function of the actual companies or exchanges and not really the Bitcoin protocol. So, you know, it's just a function of the market maturing. So in the early days, you know, the market was pretty immature. The security practices, a lot of these exchanges were still in their infancy. And, yeah, you know, consumers losing deposits is terrible. I will say it's generally, you know, a huge premise of Bitcoin is the concept of, you know, be your own bank, control your own private keys, control your own funds. Why would you keep funds on an exchange and let them handle it for you? And that's kind of outside the entire point of Bitcoin. Obviously, you need to hold deposits on exchanges if you're going to actually go to buy or sell more. But in general, good security practices are, you know, leave money on exchanges for as short of a time as possible. So, you know, if you want to buy, you know, deposit some money onto exchange, buy your Bitcoin, then send it to your own wallet that you control. Because, you know, no one's going to go and hack, like, a private key on a piece of paper that you hold securely. But, yeah, you know, it's obviously a bad look for the ecosystem when you see customers lose a huge amount of funds and not follow good security practices, but this is something that I think, you know, will quickly fade. You know, people like Coinbase are starting to employ very good security practices. You know, they have a great history of nothing like that ever happening, and sort of some of the players that, you know, have had a worse rep or have had these hacks will probably just start to fade away, or hopefully at least really revamp what, you know, what they're doing for consumer security, because it doesn't look good, obviously.
So what kind of activity have you seen since Tuesday?
Just a bunch of trading, really. Increased volume for sure. On our app, you know, we also sell Ethereum, not just Bitcoin. So people have been sort of buying that quite a bit as well. There was actually a big crowdfunding this morning for a project called Golem, which was you had to basically deposit Ethereum into sort of the Golem smart contract for a crowd sale. They actually raised $10 million in about 20 minutes. So
wow.
There's just, yeah, it's a pretty crazy trend. There's been about a ton of crowd sales this year. We've actually seen over 3 crowd sales in the past few months raise over $5 million in like less than an hour. So, you know, crypto in general is just really highly demanded lately, and it just continues to go up. You know, as we see price increases in not only Bitcoin from sort of this uncertainty around the election, but just also, you know, people want to buy Ether to get into these crowd sales. People are really sort of bullish on the expansion of, hey, you know, Ether's this platform that's supposed to run other applications, and now a bunch of other applications are starting to come to fruition. It's just a really exciting time for the space, and sort of just in the context with this huge, you know, macroeconomic uncertainty in the background, it's almost like a perfect storm is brewing to just really see how this sort of alternative currency system and really just financial system itself is starting to play out. A lot of these crowdfundings are almost starting to represent like the equities market, and some of these crowd sales are even been dubbed like ICOs as an alternative to IPOs. So initial coin offering instead of initial public offering. It's just a whole new asset class, and it's really outside, you know, any sovereign borders or traditional thinking, and it's really exciting to be a part of.
How are you regulated?
So we basically, our strategy is we do not custody any consumer funds. We rely on Coinbase, who's highly regulated and has investors like the New York Stock Exchange. So we help you basically set up a Coinbase account in the background, and we provide a front end on top of that, which is just, you know, our design, a bunch of analytics on your account, trading performance. We also do a bunch of research. Research would also be kind of a regulatory concern too if we were going to make, you know, price recommendations or tell you how to allocate your portfolio. But we really just create investment tools to let users really easily do what they'd like. Our research is just totally based on information and education. You know, I'm never going to give a price target or, you know, AAA rate any sort of asset. What we really just want to do is, you know, we're excited about the asset class. We think the information is kind of opaque sometimes. It's really just a confusing space that intimidates a lot of people. And sort of our like slogan is just, we want to demystify this asset class. So we want to take someone from reading the word blockchain in the Wall Street Journal, having no idea what that is, showing them a bunch of information and education on it, giving the investment tools they need to make whatever decisions they like, and we kind of refer people to what we view as probably the most regulated and trustworthy wallet and brokerage service in the space, which is Coinbase as our back end.
So two other questions, and then I'll let you go. So those who are investing with you, what portion of their investable assets does Bitcoin or digital currency represent? Do you have a sense of that? Is it 10%? Is it 100%? I know the demographic is young, and so there's probably not a lot of investable income there, but give me a sense of that.
Yeah, absolutely. I would say the most quote-unquote prudent investors that are viewing this more as a traditional alternative investment, so taking sort of the place of gold in their portfolio, I would say they generally put around, you know, I'd say single-digit percentage is probably the most common, so somewhere between 2 and 10% of their overall portfolio. Not only Bitcoin, but now that there's a lot of demand for things like Ethereum, you know, we'll commonly see people, you know, say, hey, 5% of my overall portfolio is going to be in crypto, And within that, you know, I'm sort of going to diversify as well as I'm doing with my overall portfolio. So I'll, for example, hold 2/3 Bitcoin, 1/3 Ether. As you said, our user base is pretty young, so obviously there's some more aggressive people that probably hold close to 1/3 or 1/2 of their overall holdings in crypto, but, you know, that's just more of the kind of hardcore guys, as I'd say. I'd say the most common is probably 2 to 10%, with actually a pretty good majority of them diversifying within the crypto space as well, just because the space is moving, you know, so fast. A lot of people are huge fans of Bitcoin. That was kind of the original crypto, you know, but now there's new technologies coming out that have similar characteristics. You know, you can also move Ether around really quick. It has an additional value proposition, so people kind of want to hedge within the space as well.
Got it. So final question. I know you said you don't predict the value of Bitcoin, but I'm going to ask you anyway. So in 2013, I remember reading someone absolutely emphatic that by 2020, Bitcoin would be $1 million, would be valued at $1 million a Bitcoin. And I'm just asking whether or not you think it will crack 1,000 this year.
I would say yes. If you had to, you know, if you had a gun to my head and told me, make a prediction, will it hit 1,000 this year? Or actually not, by this year you mean end of 2017, not in the next few weeks?
No. See, you're already hedging. The end of 2016. The end of 2016.
1,000 seems a little aggressive to me. I would probably say no, but that's just me. I'm probably more conservative than a lot of these guys. And even in terms of making very future sort of forward-looking statements, you know, I would say probably in the next, you know, 3 years, one of these cryptos will probably hit a, call it $50 billion market cap. I like to look at market cap instead of terms of like per unit price, because a lot of these cryptos have totally different supply structures.
Right.
But yeah, I wouldn't even bet on, you know, just Bitcoin alone, similar to how a bunch of our users do. I really like to diversify in this space. You know, the nature of open source software is such that, you know, any brand new technology trend, you know, if someone has a really innovative idea and they put it into an open source protocol, you know, what's stopping a guy a year from then sort of relaunching? You know, there's obviously a big network effect component, but, you know, I have no doubt in my mind that this technology will continue to grow and sort of optimize itself. And, you know, will it be Bitcoin that ends up winning out? Maybe. I'm a big Bitcoin fan, but I like just the overall idea of crypto as a whole, and I'd rather bet on the entire industry than just one project. Similar to, you know, how people invest in the S&P 500 or some industry-focused ETF, because they're like, you know, I don't know which one's going to be the winner, but I like this trend.
Yep. Picking individual stocks is risky. The portfolio strategy is interesting. Well, listen, Alex, very, very interesting and fascinating conversation about something that's been in the news a lot over the last several years, but certainly over the last several days, has taken on a bit of a center stage role given its performance as a result of the election in the United States on Tuesday. It was great to catch up. Thanks so much, Alex. I look forward to talking with you again.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
And thanks, everyone, for listening today. Have a great rest of the day and a good weekend. Until next time, thank you.
You too. Bye.